KB with the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll host a screening of Motherlode, Thursday, July 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Motherlode is a crowdsourced documentary about a new mom's quest to understand and promote the cargo bike movement in a gas-powered, digital, and divided world. This film explores the themes of movement building, activism, and courage to go against the grain. Again, that's the screening of Motherlode, Thursday, July 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, KBU members. Thank you for being part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBU Board of Directors is essential. Here's an opportunity for you to join the KBU Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KBU board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBU member. To apply, go to kbu.fm and fill out an application, or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is July 13, 2019. We are looking for folks who love KBU, who are committed to our community, and who want to carry forward KBU's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBU needs you. Apply today.
Good morning. This is KBU. Welcome to Anxious News for Anxious People with Sarah and Jonathan from Portland Assembly. Today we're joined also by MK Hansen, data activist extraordinaire. We just want to send a shout out to Paul, our regular host, who is traveling. We are here in for him and Jacqueline today. Jack, you'll be back next week. And we will be back again next month. So, welcome everybody.
Good morning, good morning.
Hey. So, a bunch of stuff happened in the last couple of weeks related to the things that we have been here on the show talking about relentlessly, and I'm sure to the great delight of our fellow nervous folks out there. And this is our I Told You So episode, because all of the things happened that we said were going to happen.
What are we talking about today?
Well, we're talking about housing once more, and we're talking about the incredible boon to developers that has happened in the last couple of weeks. We've got a YIMBY bill coming through Senate.
This is the YIMBY I Told You So episode.
Yes.
From so-called Portland.
Exactly.
Where they come to roost. That's right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, let's real quick, NIMBYism, not in my backyard. YIMBYism, yes, in my backyard. It seems so simple.
It's two sides of the same capitalist coin. It's a two-party system. I hear you.
It is, but what if there were something else?
If only.
Well, there's not been room for that in the discourse. It has been pretty much focused on either we're building whatever we want, whatever the market wants, or you're blocking us, and these are the reasons why.
How dare you hate poor people? How dare you prevent this housing from getting to them 30 years later?
There's another acronym, TINA. There is no alternative.
Oh, wow. They're really about this. What about FIMBY? I like public housing in my backyard.
I would go for that one. FIMBY, public housing in my backyard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That is actually a term that is gaining more predominance. So let's talk about the specific things that happened last week that are sort of the fruition of this long-term planning between public and private players. in the housing development and construction industries.
And that's a kind of telltale.
Well, financial industry.
Oh, yeah, one and the same. But that right there, right? It's a telltale sign of that neoliberal ethic when we hear that private-public partnership, that idea, or anything like that. Okay, just making sure I'm still clocking what we're talking about. Neolibs and YIMBYs.
Neoliberalism writ large. Yeah. Neoliberalism is, of course, the greenwashing, social washing that capitalists give their policies, which are primarily conservative and certainly fiscally conservative, which always has the effect of being socially conservative. So they try to make it more appealing to people. They try to sell things like a green core of the city or transportation corridors and things like that as things that are going to help people who are perhaps low income. Of course, those are never the people that are helped by that. They are the people who are displaced by that construction. And because none of these pieces of regulation or legislation that come through actually have any requirements for affordable housing. And affordable housing, what was the one you were telling me about, Meg, that there was something was it the 22 amendment on 2001?
Oh, the Dash 22
amendment. Dash 22 amendment that was supposed to put affordable housing for SB 2001 House Bill 2001 at 80%.
Yeah, it was basically just a very slim amendment that called the bluff. Mm-hmm. And it said, if this is actually about this, then here's this amendment. Wouldn't that be easy just to actually tether it and tether that whole word to some HUD standard of actual bona fide measurable affordability? And that was not, that amendment was not adopted.
Oh, sorry, what is HUD in this case?
Housing and Urban Development, just the standards by which they measure locally what the median family income is, and that sets the thresholds not only for HUD subsidies but also as a way of being able to actually kind of talk about income to rent and expenses.
What about the census data they were just messing with? Isn't that going to affect all those kinds of metrics and so on? Like, doesn't that have to do with it too? Is that part of this problem?
Well, HUD, well, now that Ben Carson is also a YIMBY and in HUD, they're making, I mean, that's a whole other conversation,
yeah.
But HUD is also being dismantled, you know, taking $7-8 billion out of HUD, closing down stuff and saying, well, we're creating opportunity zones and that'll take care of all of that.
But so back to House Bill 2001, mm-hmm. one of the things that I found interesting is that they proposed that, and that's an 80% RFI. So 80% of median income would be your barrier or your boundary for low-income housing, affordable housing. That's pretty ridiculous.
It's very high.
Yeah. It's very high. And even that did not get approved for a final vote. So when it was voted on, HB 2001 had no restrictions regarding affordability or accessibility.
Right. No
which
strings.
Is another really, no strings is actually the language they used.
Yeah, they
oh, wow.
used it. Yeah.
No
yeah.
strings attached, just like that. They're that
yeah,
lady.
They used that in the local residential.
Why wouldn't they? So my point all along has kind of been that clearly the public-private partnership has allowed developers to write these bills.
Absolutely.
Nothing that is going to come through is going to be what we want. And I feel that way about RIP, the residential infill. Many of the things that even the programming that we haven't been allowed to vote on, like opportunity zones and things like that, is all absolutely written by developers for maximum profit.
Well, that's been kind of the recourse in our show, right? These are the same exact people at the federal level setting policy standards at that time, at that level already. And I kind of wanted to correct myself because I've mentioned it on the other show, and it's kind of the framework I'm coming from, that growth coalition theory. And I said Peter Madroff. I believe that's actually a contributor to Strongtown's blog, which you should also check out. But Domhoff, growth coalition theory, this is the guy who talks about the fact that this is just how it goes, that this is just always the pattern of development and transit, and then you get big developer interests and so on and so forth. Like,
speaking of growth coalition theory, another thing that happened last week was that Sonia Trauss, who is a large proponent of YIMBY policy in the Bay Area.
The YIMBY, right?
Yeah. Oh. Was appointed to the Up for Growth Board, also occupied, headed, I believe, by our own Clyde Holland.
Ted Wheeler's on that too, right?
No.
Okay, just Clyde
he
Holland.
He can't be.
He can't be.
But he might as well be.
Give him a minute. We'll see what happens in this election.
Got it. If he doesn't win, he goes there. That's how it works. I gotcha.
Well, he'll go somewhere.
Yeah, there's a door opening, right?
He came from somewhere. He'll go back there.
Revolving doors.
So anyway, what other things have happened over the last week that contribute to this narrative?
Well, there was sort of, within the span of a week and a half, there was House Bill 2001, which was preempting local control over land use. Which was pushed through at the state level by Tina Kotek. And then around that same time, a Republican U.S. Senator from Indiana brought forward the YIMBY Act. Actually called the YIMBY Act.
Amazing.
And then the following week, Trump signed an executive order that is basically sort of that same narrative. Which if there was any doubt when you guys were talking previously about who writes these things and who benefits and how this narrative is shaped around that, the executive order really bears that out. So not only are all those "yes, in my backyard" sort of false narrative talking points repeated, but then also clarified to say these are all the things that are impediments to building affordable housing, like environmental protections, like rent control, like tribal land, like tribal governments, and this whole long list that is no surprise that is an agenda of the Trump administration, but it really removes that very thin veil that had been there between the YIMBY narrative and who it served.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Hey, so I just want to give out the telephone number if you'd like to call in. It's 503-231-8187, and we'll start taking phone calls in a few minutes here. So how did they manage to get this narrative across? I feel like there are some things that I keep seeing repeated in the press, mm-hmm. in various articles, that just demonstrably are not true, like the lack of housing stock, the lack of supply.
Mm-hmm.
I would want to point out also the history of our YIMBY in chief being the person in New York who had effectively gamed the system to build the public housing projects that were there, and now through the census manipulation, my understanding is they're targeting these public housing projects. So it's effectively the same kind of scam that these pump and dump home builders pulled in 07-08, right? Build up the houses on tax credits, clap up the prices once they go bust, and then rent them back to everybody. It's like this continuous idea. Like, Trump is the same kind of guy. Mm. And now I hear YIMBY's getting on board with it. Like, oh, well, you know, he'll let us build affordable housing now. Like, we'll at least give on that side of it.
Well, and it's interesting because he's also signaling at the same time that he intends to target houseless people.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at that sort of intersection, that we are both going to hit housing for the poor, so affordable housing, government housing projects, things like that, these last bastions of like cheap rent. And we are also going to, I assume, monetize houselessness in some way. Like, this is, push them into the prison system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've been building up the prisons forever now, haven't they?
Yeah, so this is a pretty clear attempt to build a direct shunt into the prison system for poor people, in my opinion. But honestly, it's not surprising. Like, if we look at the history of real estate, if we look at, I mean... Joey Gibson, our own little friend, came here. Joey Gibson is the leader of a alt-right group called Patriot Prayer that
harassing Portland for
comes
3 years.
Here to harass people. But I want to point out that he originally came to Portland to harass houseless people after the Springwater Trail was cleared.
Mm-hmm.
That was his first appearance here. So real estate agent.
Under the same indignant religious kind of, the impure on the streets and the pure, blah, blah, blah.
Well, I mean, there has to be a moral element to it because this is America. So there has to be a reason that they're there and that we're here, right?
God and guns, right? Yeah.
So let's be clear that this racial capital, nothing has changed,
no.
And all of this is in service of white supremacy.
Absolutely, and sometimes they do these things that make it so clear.
Yeah,
but also this I noticed that a lot of their work is about obscuring their actual goals.
Yeah.
So, let's get into those big lies, the big NIMBY lie or YIMBY lies that have been repeated. There are NIMBY ones too. I think they're both pretty wrong.
They both are foils to one another is what I've realized. NIMBYs make up ridiculous points that have nothing to do with what's going on, and YIMBYs provide a solution that's half-baked at best.
I would say that NIMBYs, bona fide NIMBYs, that they hyperbolize from a self-centered place, and the YIMBY narrative is just so much more dangerous and wrapped in so many layers of very calculated deception. So even though they are sort of, even though the framework says you're either yes or you're no, those people that are bona fide NIMBYs they're not being funded by billionaires, and they don't have a think tank giving them talking points.
Ooh, elaborate.
No, but they do all share a cultural background.
True. Yeah.
So if you live in
Laurelhurst,
you don't need a think tank with your neighbors. You already have a neighborhood association, and you all agree.
Yeah. Well, this whole YIMBY narrative. That creates this idea that they are they're taking this moral high ground, when really it is in service of that same kind of exclusivity, mm-hmm. and it is in service of this monoculture.
Yeah, and I want to clarify, I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with neighborhood associations. I think they can be great, but I do think that I have been to neighborhood association meetings in some of our more exclusive neighborhoods, mm-hmm. and they definitely function as think tanks. They definitely
not to harp on that too much, but I did have that experience with it, and I've seen this stuff about where they're trying to defang them and so on. That's another YIMBY shill I've noticed. They're trying to remove specifically, nothing else really, the power to appeal these kinds of zoning changes or mm-hmm. demolitions or anything, because a neighborhood association can do that for free. If you didn't know that, if you're a neighborhood association, you can appeal these things for free mm-hmm. forever, and that's what they're trying to remove. So yes, they're exclusive in rich parts of town, but yes, they also service people who need them in the areas that they are, and they should be tooled up to be stronger.
Absolutely.
But when you paint everyone who's not in lockstep with the same brush, and when you have billionaire developers who are partners with the world's largest global private equity corporation,
who's
blaming
that?
Clyde Holland, blaming this entire nationwide housing affordability crisis on NIMBYs, as if they have more power, as if they are exercising so much power nationwide in every city that developers are just powerless because they are so in the way, and that's part of that that scapegoating and don't look over here at what we've done and continue to do with deregulated finance. Look over there at those NIMBYs, and everybody who's not us is them.
Well, and it also strips the entire conversation of nuance. So it sets us up as either, you hate poor people and you don't want anyone to live anywhere, or mm-hmm. you are welcoming and want people in your neighborhood, which of course belies the truth, because if you don't build anything affordable for people, then you won't have neighbors who are not just like you.
And I think you brought up the main point in question, which is, why are things unaffordable? And it's because we're relying on a market, right? And I do believe a caller, I think it's Mitch, and we spoke with Mitch before, maybe. Let's see, you want to tap in with Mitch?
Yeah, I'm the guy that has called in asking for better definitions of neoliberalism that's elegant and people can understand, because journalists never use the term. They say it's only something they talk about in universities. But neoliberalism really is when free markets create social problems, neoliberalism insists that the solutions be market-based.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what we're talking about right now, right?
On point.
Yeah, it's exactly what you've been talking about. But what I'm hoping you will do is what journalists are not allowed to do in their advertiser market-based system run on real estate advertising, which is ride the buses around Portland, see buildings like, have any of you seen this new building that went up called Portland Girl?
I don't know if
it's
I have.
Right near the Morrison Bridge, across from that little used bookstore, Mother Foucault's, called Portland Girl. Brand new building. It started out as condos. Now, of course, it's gone to leasing. And what journalists don't do is follow every one of these public-private partnerships that have built these buildings while the homeless are piling up on our streets, and these are vacant units that can't rent because we are still talking about a 20 or 50 cent increase to the minimum wage. So what I'd like you to do is go building to building of these monstrosities that have gone up and are now vacant and tell us the story, not of the people behind it, but of the building. Where the money came from to build it, where the investors are seeking their satisfaction now, and if the units are empty and people are living on the street, why is there no pressure put on the politicians about that? Well, you know, public-private partnerships have been discredited by the presence of homeless on our streets. So it's not like we have to keep talking about supply and demand.
Yeah.
The failure is there, but nobody is profiling it.
You would think that people would actually understand that concept yet, that if there are houseless people sitting outside a building with empty units inside of it, then that market is not working.
There's a relationship.
But people don't get that the news. They don't turn on the news.
It is because there is a huge amount of pressure behind this narrative that they are putting out.
This is our job. We have to be the popularizers of what can't be spoken of in the corporate media.
We're doing it.
Oh, we appreciate you.
So what you need actually is a data activist. And MK is going to have some stuff coming out next week that should be pretty interesting. I think next week.
Yeah, I'm just making it sort of honing it together so that it's very easy to compare and contrast, unpacking all of this. You know, sort of down to its essential parts takes a lot of digesting because there's so many layers of fallacy. But also, I think that that part of what you get to, and part of what I've been doing, is trying to collect that data. You know, I've had my eyes on these things for a long time, and part of what makes that difficult is that the places where the data that we need to sort of cross-reference and quantify is sort of intentionally fragmented in different silos in the bureaucracy, and difficult, expensive to get to. And so I spend a lot of time just going in and consolidating that data on my own server, and then letting the data itself, letting the information give up its own truths and its own narrative, rather than creating a false narrative first, then cherry-picking data, and then putting it in between two slices of a value sandwich, and serving it up so that the cherry-picked data goes down easier.
I just hope you don't get lost in the weeds of data, because data doesn't actually shape policy in this country.
I understand.
You can look at the rhetoric, and all we would need would be people with websites to take their phone cams to these buildings that have been built, and that they were built as condos. They couldn't sell as condos because people don't have that money. They changed to leasing, and they remain vacant while the homeless are in every nook and cranny of the public space.
And we're still fighting
and
this
we
argument.
We need people to embarrass journalists. I mean, I really have seen some progress. I mean, I don't know if you got. I listened to The Enemy, right? I listened to NPR, and On the Media was my considered enemy program because it's run by. Actually, it was run by Brooke Gladstone, but Bob Garfield was a key member of the public relations industry for years, and he's running NPR's only program that does media criticism. But for some reason,
the irony is thick.
But for some reason, all these contradictions and the desperation of our times forced Brooke Gladstone, his boss on that program, the last 4 weeks to do a series.
We got to get going on here, man.
Here's what I would say
on eviction.
Here's what I would say.
Now, if public radio can focus on evictions, then I think KABU can focus on empty new buildings that are supposed to house the working poor.
Mitch, it's good to hear from you again. We'll definitely try, and we'll reach out to you if we get that data. And we definitely appreciate anybody contributing. If you think that's a good idea, let's start it. I'm with you. Let's get it up.
One of the things that I think this actually leads to is talking about one of the other lies, which is zoning issues. And we're going to go to another caller in a minute. But just real quick, I want to talk about in regards to what Mitch said. One of the problems is that all of these maps that these groups are using have basically been flattened. So if there is a single family zone or single family zoned lot on a block, that entire block is considered by that map to be single family. One of the things that that MK is working on that is going to help is kind of blowing apart those maps and finding out what the actual houses underneath are. So what those buildings are, what those lots are actually zoned for, that kind of thing.
Even besides zoning, I feel like me as a person renting with my roommates in a single family neighborhood, I pay for a single room. Who's mapping that, right? Like, that's just rolled in there, right?
Well, I live in what is zoned a single family neighborhood in a fourplex, across the street from two apartment buildings, next to a single family building. Like, there's a great mix in most of our Portland inner neighborhoods of housing.
And this is one of the foundations, one of the pillars of the false narrative. And the logical fallacy technique that they're using is actually called reification, hypostasization. And in other terms, this will resonate, basically misleading people to mistake the map for the territory. So not only in painting in only two colors, do they shore up this this extremely false narrative that says 75% of almost every major U.S. city has been taken over, is occupied by single family homes on every lot with entitled NIMBY homeowners who are standing in the way of affordability, and that's why we're suffering. When really this hovering abstraction of zoning is not the truth on the ground, and what that hovering layer of abstraction zoning really is what they want to take a giant eraser to, which is why they never, ever, ever show you maps of what exists currently, what current density, current zoning allows, and they never cross-reference ever with demographics unless they're providing some magical math for a displacement study to prove that this stuff is harmless.
But you're going to have some stuff out for us in the next week or two on that, and we will make sure that that's available on our Facebook page. We are going to go to our next caller now. Arthur.
Hello.
Hey, Arthur.
Yeah. Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to have what I don't know if it's a rumor or not, but it's an accuracy about House Bill 2001 that I'd heard.
Oh, yeah?
A few weeks back while you were discussing it, and thank you for bringing it up, but that person said that the bill allowed for the construction of apartment blocks, that is 4- and 5-story apartment blocks, 10 blocks from a transit corridor. And that kind of set me off, so I had to go and look at it and the bill, and did not find that. I found only duplex, quadplex, row houses, and assisted granny flats, dwelling units, granny flats.
I think so. There were two bills, two massive upzoning bills that were before the state, and one was Senate Bill 10, and I think that's what you're referring to. Senate Bill 10 was transit-oriented redevelopment, and by the way, that is the bill that our local billionaire and Blackstone partner Clyde Holland has been shopping around, especially in California, which basically says, you know, give us 5% of the land in a buffer zone around transit and open it up for business and let us redevelop it. And that will put housing where it belongs. So that was Senate Bill 10.
Could I just say, follow up that 10 blocks is beyond the distance that's considered accessible to transit. It's 5 blocks in standard.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And for apartment blocks, that should be right on a transit corridor.
It cuts right through all of the low-income housing that is along transit mm-hmm. centers. And this is a big fight in California. The same fight up here, it's crickets. You know, the left didn't even see it on the radar, didn't show up, didn't even recognize that this is what it is. But I will say that, and this connects too, that in this bill, Senate Bill 10, executives from Portland Metro and from the Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission testified against it by saying zoning isn't our problem. We have 1.3 million, we have capacity for 1.3 million homes, and zoning isn't the issue, right. It's the market.
Oh, wow.
Okay, well, I'll leave you with one last thing and I'll get off, but in the Oregonian yesterday, there was a list of all the crane type of buildings going up, and they were included in their affordable housing that I would estimate included between 700 and 1,000 affordable housing units going up right now. So, anyway, thanks a lot for the discussion.
Sure thing. Thanks for calling in.
Real quick, because that was thank you, Arthur, for calling. That was awesome. But that reminded me that you had posted a good link from Commune Mag, who I believe has local contributors to it, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one, Rent and Its Discontents, goes in depth a bit to some of the nuances of California's situation, particularly, mm-hmm. you know, in the wake of the Paradise Fire. And,
yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, but that's a really good article.
It's an excellent article. Yeah, it's linked on the KBOO page, the program page, and then also I'll post it on our Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
So should we take another caller?
Probably, but real quick, just because you'd mentioned Clyde Holland again and Blackstone, let's recap for people who are just tuning in maybe. Like, Blackstone is the Wall Street entity that was the product of the crash, that they won't call a crash, that is now buying up all these homes.
So, I think, too, this might also be a good juncture to kind of, you were talking about, like, how did this narrative get to be successful? How is this getting traction? How is it mm-hmm. that... And where, what is the genesis from this? And so you've been talking a lot about the actual truth of what happened, even if we just start at, you know, deregulation, if we just start looking at that last bubble, and who benefited from that. When we're talking about local legislation here and Trump's executive order, Clyde Holland, as sort of the face of the world's largest global private equity corporation, which is Blackstone, also the Wall Street's biggest landlord,
mm-hmm.
Also the private equity corporation that the UN special reporter for housing and, you know, human rights specifically singled out, saying, like, not only has financialization created a global crisis of affordability, but you, Blackstone, are one of the worst actors in this. And so Clyde Holland is in Portland Metro Vancouver, billionaire, Trump Victory Fund sponsor, Up for Growth Coalition board member, and Portland YIMBY and nationwide YIMBY sort of, this is the good developer.
Clyde Holland's the Portland for Everyone guy.
Yes.
Yeah. 1,000 Friends of Oregon, and all those.
Oh yeah, he donates plenty of money and sponsors things, and so, the pilot project for his transit-oriented development, which is just here in Hillsboro, is jointly owned by Blackstone. So so he was at Trump's side, signing this executive order.
The YIMBY Act.
The YIMBY Act is in the U.S. Senate, but Trump's executive order came right after that, and Clyde Holland was there over his shoulder, thanking him and being thanked. And Sonia Trauss, who is you know.
Wait, that's the person who said that that gentrification is the revaluation of black land to its proper price, Sonia Trauss?
Yes.
Oh, scumbag.
Yes.
Yes, and who compared anti-gentrification coalition, you know, some 40 coalitions deep in California protesting, you know, this sort of same statewide, taking a giant eraser, basically referred to all of those anti-gentrification and displacement coalitions as being equivalent to Trump and his wall. So that they were the racists. They were the ones that were you know building walls around their communities.
Well, and that's definitely a narrative that keeps getting pushed, yes. Despite the fact that coalitions against these groups are full of low-income groups, groups representing historically black churches in historically black neighborhoods that are holding on to the last of what they have there.
Well, they're not buying it. That's the thing, is that you know, it's one thing when you're here in, like, white Portland and people, you know, who are saying, like, well, I'm kind of on the fence about this YIMBY thing. Maybe we just can agree to disagree. They don't necessarily have this generations of lived experience that say, like, nope, I know exactly what that is because I've seen it for generations. And so because they're not buying it and because there's these coalitions, like, there's even so much more fierce rhetoric being thrown at them, which in some ways, you know, makes that agenda a lot clearer than it is up here, where it's just sort of this nebulous, smiling value sandwich.
Or in Minneapolis, there was recently the same bills going through their equivalent of RIP, residential infill, and low-income groups, houseless advocates, low-income housing advocates went crazy about it. Like, it was a huge brouhaha.
And yet the narrative says the YIMBY narrative, the stuff that gets out through and broadcast wide, says the only people objecting to this are entitled wealthy white homeowners, when actually people are hitting the streets, people of color, you know, 40 coalitions deep in California and in LA and making a lot of noise. And yet that is not that's not making its way to the people that are passing this legislation through. And if it is, they are ignoring it.
Well, real quick, just because that really belies the history here in Portland, where they've effectively, through policy, eviscerated the black community here, the only one in North Portland, right? Through those policies, the federal policies back in the day, that's actually what formed the neighborhood associations, was resistance to that. So here there is a history. It's just they've done a tactical job of eliminating the roadblocks, and now it's their biggest target in their portfolio, right? Like we've been talking about. But did you want to go to Erica now?
Yeah, let's take our next caller.
Okay.
Hey, Erica.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm not that well educated on all this, but one thing that has been really bothering me is that all these developers, you know, in the city, I imagine, are making a lot of money off of that. And then, meanwhile, we're closing our community centers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, especially the ones in my neighborhood, Columbia Pool, and then also they're talking about Peninsula Park, and those are both, you know, kind of still low-income areas and very well-used community centers. And I think, you know, I wrote a letter, and of course they wrote back and said that they do get some money from developers, but I'm just wondering, like, how much do they get and why don't we get more?
Well, that's enough, right? One of the results of this long time building of public-private partnerships is that you are friends with all of the people who are in these companies. So you want to give them a good deal. And we end up, even if you look back before the crash in 2008, when companies were building here, when there was a lot of development going on, say on the South Waterfront, all of that was pretty much tax-free for those developers because they were giving so many incentives just to build here. And, you know, they say that they're going to put those incentives in play when the market is tough, but they don't take them off again when the market goes high. So these people are shoveling money out of Portland, like literally rolling it away to Australia in wheelbarrows. And we are profiting very, very little by it. Like, the amount of money that these people put into our infrastructure is absolutely negligible.
Well, I don't even understand why we need to give them incentives. I mean, it's an incentive enough just to come to Portland because we're not having as many fires. And, you know, everybody wants to move here already. They're going to build here. They should be paying us.
That's well, they should. Yeah. Absolutely.
How come that's not happening? Well, and who can I contact about that?
Well, and this is the history of just extracting. Yeah. This is the history, though, of just this not only just this wealth extraction, but also roll back neoliberalism. And roll back neoliberalism basically intentionally creates this dichotomy between like this austerity with the budgets that have to do with the public service. And funnels and says, like, look, you know, these things are just like the community centers are falling apart because of deferred maintenance. Yeah. And that was a systematic, you know, pulling back to say, well, you know, maybe we'd be better off. Maybe the private sector could do this better. And then maybe we could just spend less of public's money giving vouchers over there to these private community centers.
I mean, honestly, we have to recognize this is why we're anti-capitalist. It is because this is the eventuation of these systems.
Yep.
It just is. They will get bought out.
Yep.
The people in power will consolidate power and money and do everything that they can to take it away from the rest of
us. This is American pragmatism at work, right? This is economic rationality.
Yeah.
This is how it goes.
Well, and I think also what we're getting at, too, is that the reason for this false narrative, you know, racial capital has created this false narrative, and right now we're just sort of talking about housing. But part of the reason for that is they know that what we talk about here is true. They know what happened. They know who is to blame. And so what they've done is they've completely taken those truths and inverted them, and to say no, there's a shortage. There's always been a shortage. Capitalism does not create abundance.
Yeah. We're going to talk about that one next, the shortage lie, because I feel like that's important. But maybe we should get Sean.
Thank you, Erica. We appreciate your call.
Right, yeah, thanks a lot.
Real quick, just because I want to recap for people to tune in, because this ties in so well with Growth Coalition. You mentioned Clyde Holland and SB. Was that first, the Senate bill? In any case, this is the pattern. They invest in the infrastructure first. They plop down a bunch and they get the city to have some skin in the game, who's incentivized to raise the land rents, right? So like that's the whole problem with this setup, is that the city itself is part of this corporate entity that seeks to increase the land rents, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay, so like that's
why do you think they want a baseball team?
Why do they just want
it's so the developers can build a whole new city around the baseball
stadium.
Just
like the Olympics, right?
Tourism spent a lot of money there.
Okay, let's take our next caller. Sean, are you ready?
Hey, good morning.
Hey.
In a kind of breathtaking obscenity, you know, oftentimes politicians will say, well, poor and working class people don't vote, therefore it's as if they don't exist. They're not even a constituency. And, you know, this is, you know, ignoring the entire history of, like, Martin Luther King being murdered as he's trying to get a poor people's movement started, and Ronald Reagan firing the air traffic controllers, the whole union busting era. It seems like when we're talking about housing policy, what we're basically talking about is that working class and poor people have no leverage through trade agreements. They don't need us as consumers and they don't need us as workers either, as a result of automation and so forth. So working class people who are non-unionized, who have no radical base, we have no leverage. We have no pushback. So, you know, in a way, I hate to sound conspiratorial, but I mean, this is basically like a horror movie in real time, where you have a superfluous population that is fit for nothing but orderly liquidation. I mean, so like, only hope it seems like we have is if like a Tulsi Gabbard, Bernie Sanders can come in and put real teeth back in our labor laws, because so long as people can't form labor unions that have real teeth and a real pushback, I don't see where we get any leverage from.
Don't look to politicians to put teeth back in programs that they took teeth out of.
We've got to put that there ourselves. Historically speaking, labor unions were the way in which poor and working class people demanded more from capital. And without labor unions, you tell me where the leverage comes from.
I'm not saying we shouldn't reify unions. I'm saying we shouldn't expect politicians who have systematically dismantled those unions to do so. We can't wait for a Bernie Sanders of any sort to do anything. Like,
Well, to that end, I mean, unions are interesting because I've had a bit of interaction with them now, and there are some shifts, actually, because, I mean, unions also historically were the body of recuperation into the capitalist machine also, and they were the ones who had sympathetic interest to industry, so short-sighted that they were willing to compromise in some ways, and or they were sent in, you know, businesses mm-hmm. basically broke them up through bad actors.
I would also say that general strikes are an interesting concept because they don't require a union. A general strike, a wildcat strike, that sort of thing, a rent strike,
mm-hmm.
Is something that can be taken on independently. Maybe you and one other person that you know who rents from the same person started. It doesn't necessarily have to be a unionized thing. It certainly will put us in positions that, you know, if we aren't prepared, like, and that's one of the reasons that formal unions are helpful, is that you can pool your resources and prepare for that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, things are getting pretty drastic, and it may well be that we'll have to take action. And I am just really cautioning you against waiting for an elected official mm-hmm. to spark that action.
Also, to the point of leverage, one thing, that's something we've told people about the orgs we work with, is it's not an org as much as it's a method. The popular assembly method is something the world over that has been used in times like this to get through decision-making processes that are necessary to figure out mm-hmm. what's going on outside the power structure.
I think too, not to sound conspiratorial, but part of the truth of what actually happened, which was just sort of an exacerbation and magnification of what racial capital has been doing since 1492, is that our first housing bubble and burst, essentially at the end of the day, Wall Street private equity billionaires colluded and committed a global criminal conspiracy that extracted, that robbed trillions of dollars, that made 10 million people homeless overnight, that dispossessed millions of people of the homes that they lived in, and
this is part the financial crash?
Yes, and part of the change is that you know, if people actually wake up and say that's what happened, and out of that, you know, right out of that, people were saying, like, people were pointing the finger, but the solution to that is regulation and punishment, taking away their toys, taking away their ability to do that ever again. And that is why this false narrative is so full of so many layers of studied, calculated propaganda, because that's what's at stake, and because that, and also because capitalists know that their time is short. They know that this game isn't sustainable, even though it's lucrative for them. They know that they're killing the planet and the people on it, and yet they're doubling down.
Because they can escape in their escape pods. That's their whole plan, is to go to New Zealand and all these other areas that'll be okay in climate change and be like, well, it opens up trade routes. That's great.
Well, they'd rather do that to the nth degree and just accelerate the assembly line than to dial it down and achieve some sort of equilibrium. But they'll dress it up in all sorts of distractions.
So we're floating off into the deep waters of anti-capitalism now, which I'm super into, as a seafarer. But also, I want to bring it back. We've got another caller, Mark. And I also want to make sure that we touch on the underbuilding myth before we go. I feel like that's a really important
one. It really is. Yeah.
So
we did get into it, too. This is KBOO Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with Jonathan and Sarah. Nervous, nervous morning about this housing stuff we're talking about. But also, if you want to call in, the number is 503-231-8187. We have about 10 minutes left, and we're going to take our next caller, Mark. Is that right?
Yes.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. Thanks so much for this important program. I wanted to offer a few resources. One is the Vienna Housing Fund. They buy up potential development property and prevent speculation.
Nice.
And the rents in Vienna are half the rents mm-hmm. in Munich.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a concrete example. Another related resource is academia.edu. This could be our public publisher. They have 20 million papers.
Nice.
And if you do a search on Vienna housing, you'll come up with almost 10 different studies, some by professors. Another point I wanted to make was that the old post office should become a village of SROs.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm a jaded ex-San Franciscan, you know, so I can see the negative. I can't understand. Do the office holders have the office holders forgotten what SROs are?
Mm-hmm.
Single resident occupancy? They're a really valuable form of community.
They haven't forgotten. In fact, in San Francisco, they are now rebuilding them as dorms. So if you work for an IT company, you can go live in a bunk bed in a room with eight other people who work at IT companies for $1,200 a month.
Just $1,200.
So they have reimagined the SRO to make it less private, to give you less of your own space, and to make it feel far more transitory.
But more expensive.
And twice as expensive.
There has to be a nonprofit or cooperative housing department, because private developers cannot afford to build affordable housing.
Maybe we just don't need private developers.
I think that's really the way out of this, is the whole private thing needs to go away. But just because I'd seen it recently, there's actually a very good example in the Bay of Hasta Muerte, where the community had come together to actually form a land trust. Mm-hmm. And we've spoken at length about land trusts here. And Meg has mentioned this is a continuation of colonization, right? This is the new way to fuse those things into value. So that is a really good model to look at. And the city of Ghent actually has a lot of commons projects and public housing as well. And they are more about having them be autonomously run. So that's another one that's worth checking out also.
And we're building boutique hotels after boutique hotels. Mm-hmm. And the only question is, why aren't there more boutique hotels?
Yeah.
That's what we need.
Because it's a NIMBY or YIMBY argument. You know, you get on board or you don't. Do you hate poor people or what? Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mark. It's nice talking to you, though.
So let's go back to that we didn't build enough housing thing. Now this is something that I have, even in articles that seem to kind of get it, even in articles that are pushing a, hey, what if we thought about a middle ground narrative? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're still starting from that place of believing that we do not have enough housing stock. Mm-hmm. And this baffles me, because I can walk down the street and see empty housing stock.
Yeah.
I know that there are, I mean, as I said, I was familiar with the South Waterfront developments. There are still like huge, huge lacks of occupancy in that building, and also people who will never be in residence because they are out of state, out of country owners. If a portfolio owns the unit next to you, who's your neighbor?
Yeah, and honestly, I didn't actually know the whole setup for the South Waterfront, but I understood it to be this project that was supposed to be a big deal for affordable housing.
It was. They got halfway through it, and then the market crashed, and then all of the affordable stuff got left out of the package. They built all the for-profit stuff first, of course, and then they ran out of money, quote-unquote. Of course they didn't. They never run out of money. And stopped building. So they did not fulfill the end of the project that actually had that earned them the affordable housing credits.
Oh, God, just because I need to get it out so bad. This is exactly what we're talking about. These people don't run out of money. They constrict the credit, right? So when it's convenient for them, they will stop all the lending and clap up the price difference, because they were the ones who knew the assets were bad in the first place, because they created them. So this is literally at their whim. This is like the city that Hartman talks about all the time. This is just white guys and what they want, imposing it on literally the entire economy, right? Like, this is old rich white guys doing that. That's,
we let them build the entire legal system, yo.
Yo. Who did that?
So
other white guys.
So part of rewriting history because people are mad that and what happened was awful. Part of rewriting history. So this narrative is predicated on on completely sort of glossing over and lying about what actually took place once finance was deregulated in 1999, which created this speculative fervor, this irrational exuberance, as they call it. And one thing to just sort of remind people of is that when they are actually securitizing the mortgage debt as a financial instrument, they still need raw materials in the real world to be able to generate that debt. But the raw material is secondary, because the debt is actually what is being packaged up. And so in that bubble, it created, you know, by conservative estimates, in the New York Fed sort of did a retrospective study in 2012.
On the crash then?
The crash. And also hyper supply is also why flippers couldn't, at the top of the market, couldn't continue to do what they were doing. And that's why the decline, and that's why then predatory lending came in. But what happened in that Ponzi scheme, where you actually sort of just need to create through raw materials these vessels to create mortgage debt, and that those financial instruments they leave behind artifacts.
Well, I want to talk about the way that demand is used in this context, because when we hear supply and demand, like, that's a pretty simple concept, right? We all kind of got that.
That's the one the YIMBYs throw at us all the time.
No, though. It's based on, I mean, it's based on fallacies. But but it is a concept that we are taught in school, in, like, economics. We kind of get it. But what they're doing is using a different definition of demand. So we think, hey, demand is how many people need houses, right? Mm-hmm. For them, demand, once your properties are portfolios and they are no longer real, that demand shifts, because it's the demand of your shareholders rather than the demand of the people who are using the product. So what there is a demand for profit. There is a demand for growth. There is not an actual demand for housing.
And there is demand. There is demand for rapidly appreciating securitized debt.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And because the interest on debt is also compounded, so it snowballs, and that's why it's so profitable. That's why we're now in an era of an everything bubble, because all sorts of things have been securitized around debt, and this idea when the false narrative talks about supply and demand, they're intentionally conflating what we understand as demand, which meaning needed housing, and supply, which we think is places for people to live, with supply of asset-backed securities and demand for rapidly appreciating financial instruments. And yet they twist those around to say there's a shortage and it's not meeting demand, but there's an abundance of units. They're just servicing expensive debt, which is creating profits in these private and public bonds.
So you'd say it's a different kind of demand, which I absolutely hear. And I think that's real, but it's also the same exact demand that capitalism always uses, right?
Oh, sure. So, but I'm just saying they're lying about what they mean by it. They want us to think that it means the number of people that needs houses.
No, totally. That makes total sense. But again, it kind of comes back to this problem that the city, like, tax system is set up to encourage that. It's set up to incentivize increasing land rent. And it's stated in, like,
absolutely,
the way that it's written, the way that the American city is built, that's all part of it. So it's integral. We literally would need to shift to an anti-capitalist model of development to do so, because this isn't ever going to give you 100% occupancy where everybody has a house, because it's at the whim of the person who owns the place to create that open, you know, opportunity to lower the price. So this is about price inflexibility, and something about land that I hear a lot is, oh, well, the price doesn't come down, or like a downward motion on the prices is what they say. Downward motion. No, it's not. It's inflexible with land because it's not a commodity. There's only so much land, and they can just rack it up and up and up, and they have since the beginning of cities, and that's what we're seeing here. And this actually happened in Rome. Well, this happened in Nero.
And I would also say that urban planning is complicit in this. Urban planning is complicit. And especially now, when you see my maps, you'll see all those urban planners, They know what the truth is on the ground.
Real quick, I just want to say there was a 2012 New York Fed report.
Ooh.
Yep.
That I will find links to and make sure are available. But looking at that is a real important link in actually parsing this supply-demand thing and what the demand is for and what the supply is for.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think...
Probably time to wrap up, right?
We're getting about to the end of it. But yeah, I think that... we have the demand right now is free housing,
mm-hmm.
free public housing. And we have to figure out how to get there. And I think that there are a lot of ways, and we use the word expropriation, mm-hmm. But it can look like a lot of things. Mm-hmm. A rent strike is expropriation. Writing legislation for a bureau that builds free and affordable housing is expropriation. Community mm-hmm. land trusts are expropriation. This direct action like squatting
divestment is also divestment.
Yeah.
Well, this also already exists as a city mechanism that they used on Black Portland, right? Eminent domain is expropriation. Look at Berlin. We got ideas,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it is coming up to the top of the hour, and this was Wednesday morning KBOO Talk Radio with MK Hansen, data activist, and Jonathan and Sarah from Portland Assembly. Paul Rowland, your regularly scheduled host, will be back shortly visiting beautiful Italia at the moment.
We have Radio Zine coming up at 9. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on The Dirt Bag, host Glenn Anderson and guest Jim Gilbert talk about how to maximize production, or is that yield, in your home garden. That's the kind of production maximization we're talking about.
Oh yeah, I like food.
Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on donate.
Please donate.
Anxious news for anxious people. Thanks so much.
Bye.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices of a People's History, a movement of movements, on Wednesday, July 10th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. Voices of a People's History celebrates diverse movement leaders by sharing their stories. Members of our community perform readings of notable speeches and essays from inspiring figures past and present, a radically empowering opportunity to hear the echoes of history in the present day. Again, that's Voices of a People's History, a movement of movements, on Wednesday, July 10th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
You're listening to 90.7 FM KBOO Portland. It's time for Radio Zine.